Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a conversation about gender, about who we are as men and women in this world, and the way we behave, the way we think, the way we act, how we learn things. Are they biologically driven? Is it a social construct? Is it both? This is a debate we've been having, I think, for a long time now, I think especially fueled since the 1960s, even more so, with the battle to end racial discrimination and then the battle to end gender discrimination, and the growth of the women's movement, the women's liberation movement in the 60s, opened up a whole vista of thought about who are we and just why do we behave the way they do? Are men really – men and women really act differently because of our biology, because of the how we're made up physically? Is that part of our identity? What's the difference between gender and sex? How does that play into the role of who we are? How do we learn? Is that really defined by our genders or by being a man and a woman? And what does gender mean, for God's sake? Is it man and woman? Is it something else now that we're beginning to find out about who we are? So it's a complex subject. And this came up in our studio here, in our offices, some months back. Christina Arison, who's producer here at the Mark Steiner Show, who's about to take off to Germany on her Fulbright, we had this raging discussion about gender differences in the and whether they were innate and biological or social construction. And we said, let's put on the show. Let's have another series of conversations about this, and we'll begin them today. Our guests are Dr. Diane Halpern, who joins us by phone. She's the author of Sex Differences in Cognitive Abilities. She's a professor of psychology at the Claremont McKenna College and past president of the American Psychological Association. And Dr. Kate Drabinski is a lecturer in the Gender and Women's Studies Department at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, UMBC, and director of the WILL program. And Dr. Jennifer Williams is a visiting assistant professor of women's studies at Goucher College and a blogger at Miss Magazine. And welcome all. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Happy to see everybody.
So, I have to ask you first, what is the WILL program? Then we can jump into this conversation.
It's a program. It stands for Women Involved in Learning and Leadership. And it's a leadership development program for women, though we do have members who do not identify as women. Okay. So it's actually a good example of how complicated gender is today.
So it is a very complicated issue. And I think that this whole question of how we are defined and how we define ourselves. I mean, let me start, Diane. You've been studying this for a long, long time.
Oh, yeah. My first edition of the book came out in the late 80s. It's the fourth edition, and it's been something that I've studied for decades. So obviously I have some very strong feelings about the topic.
And do you think that that's just my thought at the beginning of this program was how this kind of began as a kind of a raging subject in our societies. That kind of I put it to the beginning of the women's movement that kind of actually opened the vistas and doors to the world and to women and to men as well, and that created this new dialogue.
I think it's an age-old topic, going back probably as long as humanity, understanding the differences between women and men. But certainly it came to public light during the women's movement in the 60s, and certainly with the 40th anniversary of Title IX this week and a number of other issues, a leading issue in Atlantic Magazine on women having it all or not, it's a topic that's still very much with us and alive.
So let me take a large question, and this is the question of the social construct versus biology, or if it even is a question of versus, and how we define that between men and women. And even when I say this now, the complexity of the question runs through my head because of I don't even know how to define the definitions of sex and gender anymore. That becomes part of the confusion, like part of the issue and that confusion, part of the complexity. So where do we fit in this? I mean, this debate over social construction versus biology or the mix of the two.
You know, go ahead, Diana.
I could say what I say is it's a false dichotomy.
Yes.
You can't say that this is the contribution of biology is not zero. There are biological underpinnings on what makes us female and male. But the social construction is also critically important. And the two are so intricately entwined, it's very difficult to pull them apart, which is why I think you get into trouble with the terms like sex and gender, which suggest that, you know, something is biological and something is socially constructed, when in fact the two are closely entwined. Even our most biological markers like brains or hormones, are changed by our experiences. And our experiences determine, you know, other experiences. So that, they're, you know, it's really not something that one can pull apart.
Yeah, I would agree on that. And
Kate Kapinski.
And my training isn't in science, it's in the humanities. But in feminist theory, the debate about the difference between sex and gender is an old one, sex being biological and gender being social. But just as Diana said, you can't really separate them. You don't even have an idea about looking for biological sex until you have a social idea of gender that makes that sort of a primary difference. And yet you don't, you know, gender doesn't build off of nothing, right? There's also biology and matter play a really big part in our gender. So I would actually completely agree that it's that you can't separate them. There's no way to isolate the biological from the social, because the second we ask a question, we're bringing our social world into it as we frame a question.
Right. I totally agree with what Kate and Diane have to say about that. And more so than the dichotomy between sex and gender, I often wonder why we feel the need to try to dichotomize sex and gender, and why we're trying to prove that the two are, you know, kind of like at diametric odds, or that we have to be engaged in some kind of battle of the sexes and battle of the genders, and why are we trying to kind of like oppose those things to one another. So I'm often wondering about the stakes that we have in it, rather than, you know, how much biology contributes and how much culture contributes to the differences.
Let's take that off for a minute. There's a couple things I want to raise here, and I think that would be one of them. And I think that Diane, you've written a lot. I mean, I've been reading a lot of what you've been writing lately.
Glad to hear it.
and there's a lot to wrestle with here. Let me just start with a statement you made in one piece that you wrote a little bit ago, and again, it plays off of what Jennifer Williams just said. Which is why is this important for us to wrestle with and talk about? What does it lead to? I mean, because you said that you understand the controversies involved, but that you think that it has to be studied, that we have to understand this. Let's start from that point.
Sure. I think it's fundamental. Our understanding of how we're similar and how we're dissimilar has important public policy implications. And I think it's critically important that we keep this in, we keep educating ourselves and we keep educating the public and our policymakers. I mean, all of our programs, for example, there's a big push now for single-sex education.
Mm-hmm.
The idea being that men, girls, and boys are so fundamentally different that they need different kinds of educational experiences. This is a topic that, of course, I completely disagree with. It's based on the essentialism kind of view. But, you know, these are public policy issues, regarding affirmative action for women or for men, for educational programs, for the low participation rates of women in STEM fields, science fields, for the low participation rates of men in areas that have been traditionally female, early childhood education, where they're desperately needed. So I think these are critical, important issues.
I think that's absolutely right. There are these persistent inequalities based on gender and other kinds of difference that can't be addressed by making an argument that says men and women are biologically just different from each other. Because then the reason women aren't in STEM fields the way that men are is because women aren't as good, or their minds don't work in scientific and mathematical ways. And we know that's not true. So research has to be done. At the same time, I think we have to be attendant to all the other kinds of differences that intersect with gender, and also understand that there aren't just men and women, and that's sort of the end of that story. So research has to be done, and it has to be really attendant to the socially constructed nature of these differences. Otherwise, and I think Diane probably would agree with this because I'm agreeing with her, that the biological explanation for those differences just isn't enough.
Well, clearly not. And that's why we need to keep studying it, and that's why it's an issue that I think is very important to keep re-educating, to educate parents about it. Parents care very much about this topic, and it's really our obligation to explain that this is a muddy and complicated area, But simple explanations like it's all in mother's attitudes or all in hormones simply do not work.
As the director of the WILL program, one of the things that we do at UMBC is note that there's a real leadership gap where men are much more likely to step up into leadership positions than women in different organizations. And men just as a group have a different kind of self-confidence and assumption that their voice matters. And so mm-hmm. part of what we do in WILL is encourage women students and students who don't identify with either of those categories to sort of see themselves as legitimate leaders. And that's not a biological thing. That's a training from when you're a tiny kid in social expectations of gender that tell you that your voice matters. And it aligns very clearly also with race and other kinds of differences where certain groups think they just have a right to space in a way that other people don't.
Yeah. And okay, Jennifer. I was going to say, I also wonder how we can work to get these conversations from the realm of theory and from the sort of intellectual discussions that we're having, because we do research and we write about this stuff, but how can we also break it down to a sort of daily reevaluation of gender in the social sphere? Because I think that most people are operating under the assumptions that we've been different, it's been this way since the beginning of time, mm-hmm. you know, don't you know?
Well, let me ask this question. Let me kind of marry the two and see where there is either conflict or not necessarily fighting conflict, but what we have to wrestle with here. I mean, one of the things that hit me about all three of you were just saying, I was thinking about the research, Diane, that you were doing, and when people argue that there are innate – take that back. When people argue that there are biological differences just in terms of how man and woman – biologically function, and in the studies that people you've done, Diane, that would say that men are better at kind of various spatial skills, but women are better at verbal fluency, and those kind of studies that are done that show that that say that across geographic boundaries and different cultures, what does that mean in the context of women having what you all were describing a moment ago of the equal skills, equal role in an equitable society? I mean, what are the contradictions between that research and that, if they are, or do they complement each other? And what do they say about where we have to go?
The kinds of differences that we find are on average differences, and there's huge variability among women and among men. So it's really important whenever I hear anyone say women are like this, men are like that, mm-hmm. I mean, every one of us, everyone listening, a little light should go off in your head and say that's just a gross generalization. Mm-hmm. There are some, on average, differences that hold up cross-nationally and even cross-species. But that tells us nothing about the origin of those differences and whether those differences change over time. Mm-hmm. So the fact that there are differences tells us nothing about where they come from. We can all get better with education, and we all, you know, so it's far more complicated, but it doesn't negate the fact that there are some on-average differences in some of the abilities of women and men. If you want to look at leadership, I think the real issues there, and I have a book on this with a colleague, Fanny Chung, Women at the Top, the Powerful Leaders Tell Us How to Combine Work and Family. I think the biggest area there has to do with women's roles, caretakers and caregivers, mm-hmm. and you know, how we change society so that men have equal caring responsibilities, so that it's far more complicated. Much of what we're talking about is simply not a matter of just biology or just sociology, but of social conditions, but how the two mesh in different cultures around the world.
Yeah, and that point of on average, I think, is really, really important. And it always seems to get lost in the translation from research to the public realm, where I think people are expecting to hear that men and women are different. And we're just so settled on that expectation that when you hear on average, people hear, oh, men and women as a group, you know, men learn spatially and women are more, you know, they learn some other way, rather than seeing that the differences among the many genders are also really wide. So from my perspective, if we see that some people learn better spatially and so other people learn better in some other way, then we need to have multiple ways of teaching so that we can reach all people. And it doesn't have to be necessarily we need, you know, because girls need this, we do this thing. You know, there are people, you know, people learn differently. So the on average, I think, is really an important thing that's lost a lot in that translation.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I talk to real people, I must say on average, almost every other sentence, because that really is the critical part. I mean, on average, there are more males who have trouble reading. But that doesn't mean that we treat all boys as though they're bad readers or all girls as if though they're good readers.
Exactly.
I mean, some kids need help with reading. And, you know, there might be more boys in that class than girls. But, you know, you can't generalize to all boys or all girls.
But then I also wonder, too, why we're breaking some of those differences down to gender. Then, you know, why are we comparing how boys and girls read instead of maybe thinking about issues like class and economics and nutrition more so, and how and maybe how they interact with gender, but not just I keep wondering about even research that keeps polarizing the two of many genders. You know what I'm saying?
Well, that's how we collect our data. Mm-hmm. We have international data. We have school data. I mean, clearly we have racial and SES data, and when you hear, for example, that boys are failing, all boys are not failing. Middle-class boys are doing just fine of all races. Mm-hmm. It's poor boys that are failing. So it's really an intersection that has to do with SES. Right. So, that, you know, our poor boys are every bit as male as our rich boys. It really, so this is not so much a boy or a male-female issue. But it has to do with the intersections of being male and being poor and, you know, in many cases, being racial minorities, in the, you know, in inner cities and in urban and rural areas. So it's far more complicated than just male and female.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in my field of study, this is just a given that things are really complicated, that our identities intersect. I'm not just a woman. I'm also a white woman. I have a sexuality. I have an age. I'm from somewhere. People are more complicated than mm-hmm. Than this. And I wonder why our public discourse seems to always just let that drop.
Right.
I wonder why we're so bad at talking in complicated ways, because we all experience ourselves as complicated. Right. But when we turn on our TV or we listen to the news story about how boys are failing and is it feminism's fault or is it all that testosterone, why is that the sort of limit of our public discourse when all of us know it's more complicated than that?
Yeah, I don't think all of us know that. I think that, you know, we take our assumptions as being what everyone knows. I mean, in general, we think our groups are heterogeneous and varied, and everybody else's group is fairly homogeneous.
That's
and in fact,
true.
It's difficult to handle complex information. It's much easier. People want simple answers. When we come up, our conclusion from our paper in Psychological Science in the Public Interest, where we tackled this, was that it's complicated. And people said, huh, sounds like you don't know what you're talking about. But that is the answer. I mean, you know, we were more specific on what we said, what the complications were. But, you know, they said, you know, you got a bunch of experts together to say these are all important. And the answer is yes, because that really is the answer. But that's not the answer that's easy to digest or offers simple fixes.
So, I mean, one of the basic questions here that people always ask is, are there sex differences when it comes to cognitive abilities? That's something that maybe not like using that terminology, but that people wrestle with, you know, and all the time that it comes out that before I get into the other issue, people who believe there are innate differences.
There are on average differences that's different from innate differences, and those differences change over time. I mean, you see rapid increases, for example, huge changes in the number of girls scoring extremely high on the SAT math. Those ratios went from something like 13 males to every male to down to between 3 to 4 females to every male in only a few decades. That's not innate. That has to do with opportunities and girls taking more math classes. So, yeah, there are some on-average differences, but that doesn't tell us where they come from, and it doesn't tell us that the ones we have today are the ones we're always going to have.
Mm-hmm. So, Jennifer, I'm curious, the two of you, I mean, do you you and Kate, I mean, how do you view this part of our debate?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree with Diane's findings. I mean, I don't think that if there right, like if there are on average differences, it doesn't tell us how many teachers actually walk into classrooms with assumptions that students are going to perform according to gender, or it doesn't tell us what students have had breakfast before they've come to school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so sometimes I wonder, you know, not just about the results, but also about the questions that we're asking. Because if we're asking whether or not there are cognitive differences between girls and boys, it's almost as if we already have this assumption that the results are going to come, are going to fall a certain way. So that's the constructed nature of gender differences that we can't separate from the biological presumptions that are underlying that.
Well, from my perspective, certainly there are on average group differences. You know, at UMBC, for example, there are far more male students enrolled than female students. I think it's a 60-40 split. It's something that UMBC has identified as a problem and is trying to fix. How do we get more women into the school that has a focus on STEM fields?
Because UMBC is focuses on math, science, and technology.
Yes,
a lot of the courses.
It does. A lot of the courses. Then again, you know, 40 to 50% of the majors are in social sciences and humanities. But so on average, there are differences in how many female students are doing, you know, one thing, are doing STEM fields as opposed to male students. And so we see these group differences. I'm loath to say, and this is just because of my field of training, to say there are some. And, you know, it sounds like this is true for everybody here today, that there are biological reasons or explanations for that. Because if there were biological explanations, then there's nothing we could do about it.
Oh,
then,
that's not true.
You know, so it's just not – and so obviously that's not true. Are there differences?
Biology doesn't mean innate and immutable.
Yes,
and that's important
I know.
To understand.
Yeah.
That even if we say there are biological differences, it doesn't mean that they're unchangeable, and it doesn't mean that they are somehow innate. And I think that's probably where Larry Summers got in trouble.
Mm.
Had he not used the word innate, he might still be at Harvard today.
But you wrote about that extensively.
I called Larry Summers' comments my Full Employment Act. It kept me on the circuit tail and speaking for years. I owe him a great debt for my career.
but that, again, is part of the discussion that I think people have all the time in their living rooms, in their kitchens, and on the stoop.
It's the conversation I have in my classroom. You know, we talk about the history of sex differences and look at different ways that sex and gender are socially constructed in different historical periods and contexts, and yet students invariably will end the semester, a lot of them saying men and women are really different. Just naturally speaking, we're just really different. So I think it's so much of our common sense at this point. It's really, really hard to challenge it. So we might understand that sex differences, on average, sex differences aren't innate, but it's really hard when you're living in a world where everything you see is telling you that men and women are totally different. You know, we have movies for women and movies for men. And, you know, I shave with a Venus razor and, you know, my brother shaves with a Mach 3. You know, everything we see in society is telling us that men and women are totally different. We need different everythings. So it's really hard to get beyond that. And so then I wonder, so what, you know, in my classes, I'm trying to figure out, why are we so invested in this dichotomy in the first place? Is it, you know, who's benefiting from it? You know, where
certainly
does that investment
come in? Certainly all the people selling razors are benefiting from it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
I can see one big market right away.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think we also need to be careful that when we say different with respect to what. If we're talking about our respective roles in reproduction, we're different. And that's, you know, an important difference. If you happen to be a reproductive biologist, this is a silly discussion. If you're talking about how people learn and achieve in society, you have something entirely, you know, different in terms of what the questions are.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about what you were saying about your students, Kate, because even the professions are gendered so differently. There was just an article in the Times about how there are more men entering into professions that used to be dominated by women. So, you know, why are professions gendered so differently, and how does that play then into power and the distribution of wealth and, you know, systems of inequality in a society? Because you might have differences in terms of how many girls are majoring in math and science, because there, how many professions where, you know, math and science heavy are supposedly, you know, women's professions, right? So you have women like swelling the humanities because they're going into professions that are dominated by other women. So, you know, I think that's a conversation that needs to be had as well.
I'm going to take a break and jump into these last three different things you said as we look at gender differences, or if they exist. Do they exist? Are they biological? Are they social constructs? How do we wrestle with this in the 21st century? We're talking with Dr. Diane Halpern and Dr. Kate Drabinski and Dr. Jennifer Williams. Stay with us. We'll be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's New E-Zines. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are talking about gender and all the uproar over who we are as men and women, our sexual identities, how we're different to the same. Dr. Diane Halpern joins us. She's author of Sex Differences in Cognitive Abilities, professor of psychology at Claremont McKenna College, and a past president of the American Psychological Association. Dr. Kate Drabinski is a lecturer in the Gender and Women's Studies Department at UMBC. And director of the WILL program. Dr. Jennifer Williams is a visiting assistant professor of women's studies at Goucher College and a blogger at Miss Magazine. So, picking up where we left off, I mean, one of the things, let's talk from two different ends here. When you're in social settings, the conversations will invariably come up about how we govern ourselves.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And people, women especially, and some men, will always say that if women had more of a role in governing our society, we'd be a different place. Because women relate to one another differently than men, interact socially different than men, have a different set of relationships. Someone said to me the other night at a conference at the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, she just met another woman who's also part of our conference, and said, "We just bonded instantly because women do this in a different way than men. We don't have the barriers that men do in developing these relationships." And so, and this is, you hear that all the time. So, I mean, how does that fit into the scenario that we're different or not different, that our biology somehow innately, there's that word again, creates some kind of different social function? And I see Kate shaking her head no, she can begin.
Well, first of all, we run in different crowds because I don't have those conversations in my social circle. But I think that we live these differences as if they are really, really real. Some of us do. Mm-hmm. Others of us are running – like we're not organizing our lives around gender in that same way. So that might not be a conversation that we have. But again, I mean, everything in society is telling us that we're really, really different. So when I have that moment of connection of like, oh, see, we're really bonding because we're both women, which, again, doesn't happen to me, that's us living, you know, living our social constructions as if they are real, because they are real for us. You know, as I tell my students, in this classroom, we're going to challenge our ideas about sex and gender and what's natural and what's normal and, you know, what a proper man is and a proper woman is. And yet when I leave the classroom, I don't, personally, like, wonder who I am and all of a sudden everything that I think I know about myself has been unseated. I just go home and I order a pizza and it's delivered and I eat it and I watch TV. So, you know, and where I learn a whole bunch of things about gender. So from my perspective, the fact that those conversations happen all the time mm-hmm. has nothing to do with whether or not there are innate sex differences. And it has a lot more to do with the ways that we've been raised to do masculinity and femininity. So the part where, you know, maybe people see patterns where men don't connect emotionally with each other or men don't physically touch each other in the way that women do or something like that, that I don't think that noticing that is saying anything about innate differences from my perspective.
I absolutely agree. I think that those kinds of examples have to do with the way that we perform our gender identities with all of these underlying assumptions that women do interact with one another differently, you know, and men, you know, don't hug and, you know, they're not supposed to cry. And I mean, all of these are just kind of assumptions that we continue to fuel and that are just so commonsensical at this point, but they're not true. But we do live them as if they are true and as if they are biologically true. But I don't think – I think they're absolutely not. And I think if women ran the world, we would have a different set of problems just, you know, just that we have now. And there have been women in power who have been just as violent and just as destructive as the men who are in power now. So, yeah.
Diane?
I guess I would say a couple of things. One, I would say, Mark, you've got to keep saying on average – when you talk
Thank
about
you.
Differences, because I want everyone to get used to saying that when you make these observations, what you're saying is on average, you believe that these are differences on average. Are there differences on average? Yes. Does it mean that they've come from biology? Certainly not necessarily. We see some of these differences cross-culturally, but we see a lot of this same cross-cultural kinds of assumptions for women and men. There have been plenty of studies of women in power in organizations. And in fact, quite a few of the studies say that the more women you have on your corporate board is actually associated with better financial success. I'm quoting here from the work of Alice Egley, who's done extensive work in this area. And, you know, there were some small differences in leadership styles. Today's knowledge world is actually one that's better suited for a much flatter kind of organizational structure, which on average women tend to prefer. And do I think that those on-average differences are biological? No. But they still exist. So we have a couple things that are going on. But clearly women are well-suited for handling leadership roles in today's more complex and interrelated world, where both flatter organizational structures, more likely to share information, which is also leads to increased outcomes. And I do have references for all of these statements that I'm making. These are not, you know, my opinions. These all come from studies that I'm, you know, happy to share. They're all referenced, actually, in the book I did with Fanny Chung on women leaders.
So again, let me just probe a little bit deeper there. So what does that mean then? I mean, is it in terms of if – let's for argument's sake, they are social constructs, mm-hmm. as you were arguing a moment ago, mm-hmm. Kate. So where do they come from? Who defines that? And does that necessarily mean – does that mean there are differences in how men and women perceive things or not? I mean, what I'm saying. I mean, that's.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, and I when I say these are social constructions, well, first of all, I'll say this is why there's so much research. This is why people are doing all this research on where those constructs come from. Secondly, when I say those social constructs are lived as real, that doesn't mean that I'm saying, but they're really kind of fake, right? I mean, I think we.
You think they are fake?
No, I'm not saying they're fake. I'm saying that when I say that I live them as real.
Gotcha. Right. Sorry.
That they become our reality, and it's so easy to see them then as innate. And so I think that's why so many people think, oh, these are just innate differences, because they're reconfirmed so many times, right? If you step outside of gender norms, mm-hmm. that's when you feel the effects of not living those social constructs as real and as appropriate, right? So the, you know, people who, for whom gender is not, oh, I'm obviously a man and everybody knows it, and as I move through the world, everyone treats me as a man, right? As soon as you step outside of that social construct, you can be punished really severely and violently. You can be ostracized. So I think that we're trained really early to sort of meet those gender expectations. And we move outside of them, you know, if we're sort of if our gender is more complicated than I'm a man or I'm a woman, that's when we really start to sort of feel the way that that reality is for other people so tenuous, right? Why do you need to be physically violent with me because of you can't tell what my gender is, right? What is it that makes people snap? You know, there's so much violence against people who are gender non-normative. Why? Where does that come from? And I think some of it is it comes from having the assumption, like having one's settled assumption of the innate reality of these differences challenged for oneself, right? Because none of us are just the, you know, Barbie or Ken, though Ken's gender is a bit odd. So maybe G.I. Joe, I might go with him. But none of our genders are so clear cut as that, right? And we're always negotiating a relationship to gender norms. I think that to say they're socially constructed doesn't mean that we don't feel them as vitally essential to who we are as people.
It's like race. So, okay, you know, Jennifer. Like we know that race is constructed. We know that there are not, you know, immutable biological differences between the races, but it right. doesn't mean that the way we live race isn't very real, right? And it doesn't mean that racism isn't real. And I think gender is similar. You know, we know that there are not immutable biological differences between men and women necessarily, but the way that we live in the world, the way I walk around as a woman at night is going to be very different than the way a man walks around at night because of the way that we live these constructions.
Mm-hmm. So, well, a couple of things here. There's so much here. This is, could take days to get through, so we can get done in 20 minutes.
You can major in this, Mark.
I know, but one of my producers
you can
has.
Get a doctorate in this.
You can. I have a doctorate in this.
That's right.
One of my producers just wrote his thesis in this. So, uh-huh. So,
yes.
So that some of the things I've read that you've written, Diane, on some of the research, and again, I'm going to go back to biology for a minute.
Sure.
When you write about the differences that may affect, let's say, left-handedness that you write about, right? That might have to do with testosterone levels in someone's biology.
Absolutely.
Right? So how does that – so again, if that's that, – and that is in some senses a behavior you can't control because you're left-handed, you're right-handed. My youngest daughter is left-handed. She is just left-handed. So – but how does that affect behavior and who we are?
There are lots of influences in our behavior. Clearly, biology's role has a role in who we are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have hormone receptors in our brain. We know prenatal hormone environment is actually a rather important determinant of later behavior. But it doesn't exist by itself. It exists in a context, and the context influences, you know, how those differences are manifested. So, again, you know, I guess we have a few words that are floating around, and they're not the same.
Mm-hmm.
Biology is not the same as innate, you know, our biologies change in response to our environment. Our brains change, our hormones mm-hmm. change, and those are biological indicators. Innate and biology is not immutable, and we keep going around as though, you know, mixing up some of those terms. And I think, you know, and again, I can understand why the general public doesn't understand those differences. And it's important that we pull them apart.
Do you all want to jump in a little bit on this? So, I mean, I think this kind of in some ways goes to – because I think that people are most human beings. But maybe social is a different game.
On average.
But that our people are wrestling with this for lots of reasons.
I think people are wrestling with changing gender norms. Right.
Like absolutely.
I think that people aren't wrestling with am I innately different from my brother?
Right.
I don't think that I'm never wrestling with that. But what I am wrestling with is what are the expectations on me because of other people's assumptions about my gender? Right. So like when I go out in a skirt, which is a new thing for me, when I started wearing skirts, the world started treating me differently. And I wonder why is that? And I don't like the way the world is treating me sometimes when I'm wearing a skirt. And so what is it that makes, you know, I was just at the beach this weekend. Delaware is a lovely state. And I was sitting on the beach and I, you know, I had my hat over my head enjoying the sun. And, you know, a couple of guys were talking about how they can't help looking at women's breasts and women are always showing them off. And so why don't they expect it? And this is and they said, this is evolution. I need to look at breasts. And I'm lying there thinking, I'm off the clock. I just want to be at the beach enjoying the sunshine. And, you know, they're having this conversation and, you know, I look up at them and I give them my death stare and they don't care, right? Because they are so certain that they're right, that as biological men, they can't help themselves but look at my rack. And that's really and that sort of settled assumption that there's just an innate difference between men and women such that men are forced to look at women's breasts when if you have an ample rack, there's nothing you can do to hide it. I just want to be at the beach, you know. So my concern is less are there innate differences, then how do those innate differences operate? How do they discipline what I can do with my body on a beautiful sunny Saturday? And that's sort of my concern. And how do we stop the violence that then ensues that as long as we sort of are settled in this idea that there's an innate difference and men are just – they can't help themselves, right, then what are we supposed to do about that? So I'm really concerned with the social life of this idea of innate differences, right. Which there's no research supporting that.
Yeah, I hope you got up and moved your blanket because I don't think you were likely to engage in a meaningful discussion.
You know what? I was not going to go anywhere good.
Yeah,
so,
good.
Yeah.
Okay. And another, you know, and what in your day at the beach would have been very different in some other places around the world where you would have had your hair covered, your head covered, mm-hmm. and your body would have completely covered because of beliefs about how women and men differ.
And there were people on that Delaware beach who were completely covered from head to toe. Yeah.
Head to toe with every piece mm-hmm. of hair colored. And this is, you know, really we have to also, which is why cross-cultural and anthropological research is so important in understanding women's and men's roles. And I think you're right, roles are changing. And that does scare a lot of people. It does seem to pull away from them a lot of, you know, their understanding. And it's not surprising that there's some pushback.
Mm-hmm.
Teaching to stereotypes about girls and boys instead of understanding them as, you know, unique individuals that have needs that may or may not conform to traditional stereotypes. So I think, you know, that clearly this is part of the discussion.
It goes back to what our investment is in maintaining those roles. I mean, as gender roles are changing, who is invested in, why are they invested in being a quote unquote real man and a real woman? And what does that mean? So, I mean, it's sort of like a bit of a gender backlash happens as gender and sex roles begin to change in society. Then people kind of fall back into the sort of behaviors that will then, you know, vouch them as the real thing, like, you know, seeing, you know, noticing your rack or something, you know, in order to just kind of support themselves as the authentic article. So that's what I kind of wonder, like, what are the investments in maintaining the roles as they supposedly were, even as they're changing dramatically?
Well, there's a loss of power to groups that are traditionally in power.
Mm-hmm.
It's discomforting to find, you know, in times of change. You're not clear, you know, the rules are not as clear. I mean, I think I can understand it. It doesn't mean that I think it's a good thing, but I guess that's part of the reason why I think that our jobs are so important,
right,
and that we keep talking to the general public and really have everyone talking.
And what should we be talking about then? I mean, what the things you three just talked about this moment, especially from your beach story on, because I think that if we had people engaged in larger audiences in this conversation right now interacting with us, part of what would be coming up is that, and we could say on average, but let me say on average, mm-hmm. most people, majority of people, I would say, think that there are, and there's the word innate again, sexual differences in terms of how men and women view sexuality,
right,
and view how we look at one another, even if those with another is within our gender or without our gender, right?
Right.
So that's part of the question of what is a social construct, is or whether things are just biologically who we are part of because of our gender, because of our literal gender, physical gender. I mean, those – and so, you know, those questions you confronted on the beach or you were confronted by on the mm-hmm. beach are things that people confront and address every day.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think for a lot of women, the sort of incessant the constant undercurrent of sexual violence and objectification, right, where every time I turn on the TV, I see that what is valuable about me is my body and its availability to men. And once I reach a certain age, I'm no longer useful, in according to popular mm-hmm. culture. And, mm-hmm. and the kind of constant threat of violence, of sexual violence when I'm out in the world, right? We just – and the kind of catcalls you get and the kind of just – low-level street harassment that a lot of women face all the time. Mm-hmm. I can't move through the world if that's all I'm thinking about, right? So right. I think that for a lot of us, it's just, okay, I've learned how to move through the world and ignore some of that stuff. And yet, you know, because of my training, I never am able to ignore any of it. But I think that what we should be talking about are issues, things like power differences and access to resources and what kind of world do we want to live in and what kind of world do we want to raise our children in, sons, daughters, and our children who we might not call sons or daughters. Like, what kind of world do we want to live in, rather than can I prove that there's an innate difference, right? Then again, there's, you know, as we see sort of settled inequalities around things like gender and race, we got to figure out where those come from. And I don't think asking are they innate or not is the answer. I think it's so let's look at it. Let's, you know, research something specific and try to figure out what are the factors that are leading to this, right? So when UMBC says why are so many more male students here than female students, their question is what can we do to encourage female students to come to the school? It's not how, you know, why are women innately uninterested in coming to STEM fields or something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm being clear, but I think.
I don't think it's. Yeah, right. I hear you. Is there? When I was thinking about some of the stuff again, Diane, that you've been writing about, and I'm just. This is the beginning of a conversation I want to have many more of to kind of come to a place with this mm-hmm. or try to help us all wrestle with this.
I will keep going to the beach so that we have more research.
Now you should. I am a big fan of going to the beach. Period. We should always go to the beach.
Yes.
But you know, when I think of the research you were doing, especially on the biological side, Diane, on looking at what affects who we become, I mean, is there a contradiction between something defining us biologically and not allowing oppressive social constructs to be the dominant force in society?
No, there's no conflict. I think that there are some important take-home messages for anyone listening. And I think those important messages are that, first, there are wide varieties in the abilities and personalities and other aspects of all among girls, among women, among men, and among boys, and that we can't really talk about boys are like this, girls are like this, men are like this, because of the huge variability. We need to treat people as individuals and not as stereotypes. So biology plays a role. Biology's role is not zero. How much it is, when it's important, what does it mean, varies a lot with the type of question. It's critically important if we're talking about reproduction, if we're talking about how people learn. You know, the biology of learning is the same in females and males. They don't need different learning experiences. If we're talking about the role of sex roles or gender roles and how they are influenced, there are similarities and differences around the world that give us a good clue. And then where do we want to be as a society? And I think some of the other speakers raised excellent points about the big questions and how do we get there? How do we help every child achieve his or her best potential? Mm-hmm. And how do we, you know, encourage people to break away from traditional stereotypes, whether they're gender, whether they're racial, whether they're based on SES, and really allow us each to achieve what, you know, our very best?
Yeah, I would absolutely echo that.
Yeah.
I think that we need to imagine different ways of being in the world, and that means for some of us, breaking out of the assumptions that I'm a boy or I'm a girl and that that means a whole bunch for me, that determines my life chances. Because that's when I think we run into trouble. And I want us to – and sometimes I worry that the incessant focus on the innate differences that we see between men and women because, you know, we just bonded right away because we're both women, or I can't help but look at your tits because I'm a man, that those kinds of assumptions keep us from the hard work of imagining a different kind of world.
Mm-hmm. That's beautifully said.
It is. And if some of the studies that, you know, sort of – if some of the studies about biology can undercut some of those commonsensical assumptions, then mm-hmm. I think it can take us somewhere in terms of trying to, you know, work toward an equal, more equal distribution of power among genders, sexualities, races,
and gotcha, right.
You know, and the whole gamut.
So, I mean, I think that hearing the three of you in this last hour talk together, it's been really fascinating because, you know, what started out in terms of how we kind of thought about this program, people always want to set up it's either or there has to be conflict, as opposed to creating a conversation that looks at the complexity of what we face mm-hmm. and who we are. Mm-hmm. I mean, if one thing came out of this conversation, that was that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and that's the conversation I want to have. And that's the conversation that we can't have if our starting point is, why is there a battle of the sexes? Right. Because that – we've already decided that there are two sexes and that they're battling. And it doesn't have to be.
Well, I would never start the assumption of a battle of sexes. I think that's the Hollywood-esque Madison Avenue stuff that drives me crazy.
Unless we're Billie Jean King, then it's a battle of the sexes and she won. It's Title IX weekend.
But he
friends.
Was old.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you all for this conversation. It's been great to have the three of you with us today, Doctor.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed talking and meeting all of you, even by phone.
Thank you, Dr.
Dan Halperin, Dr. Kate Trubinsky, and Dr. Jennifer Williams. Thank you all so much. And go to steinershow.org, and you can link on to their work, their ideas, and their writings, and the work that they do. And we'll continue this conversation in the months and years to come. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our associate producer is Cassandra Monsanto. Our producers are Justin Levy, Cricket Arison, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.